Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. You can find more podcasts like this on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast features a keynote address from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Security Conference. It's a speech by Annie Anton, professor of computer science at North Carolina State University. Her presentation is entitled, Changing Mindsets in Academia, How ISOs Can Leverage Faculty to Improve Privacy and Security.
Thank you. So Rodney Peterson invited me and he asked me to speak about how ISOs can leverage faculty to work on privacy and security. It's kind of a challenging talk because he asked me to do two things, talk about our research and address these issues. So I'm going to try to do both today. So just to give you a little bit of context, we've been working in the space of privacy policy and healthcare privacy for over 12 years now. And more recently, we've been working on regulatory compliance as well. And obviously, a lot of what we do today involves the exchange of information, whether it be for government, education, e-business, healthcare. And people are very concerned about that. And for people to trust systems, we need to be able to clearly express what it is that we're doing to safeguard their information. So as a bit of an outline, I thought I'd first just to give a little overview of what I learned about EDUCAUSE's policy concerns within the space, talk about privacy as a grand challenge, and then talk about a few of our projects at NC State, and then finally close with some recommendations for you as ISOs from the perspective of a faculty member. So on the EDUCAUSE page, there's three different policy issues that seem to be the most the predominant focus. So there's communications policy, copyright and intellectual property policy, and cybersecurity identity and privacy policy. So my work has concentrated on the red one, and especially with cybersecurity and privacy policy. So that's what I'll focus on mostly. And then when you click on that link, you get to another page, and I highlighted in red the things that I want to focus on today. So this is the collection, use, and disclosure of personally identifiable information by organizations such as colleges and universities is increasingly subject to regulation. Legislation and regulation that seeks to protect and limit collection, use, and disclosure of private personal information is of interest to the academic community. It's also of interest to business. It's also of interest to government as well. So what kinds of compliance requirements are we interested in? Well, also on the EDUCAUSE page, it talks about social security numbers, FERPA, HIPAA, GLBA, HITECH, state data breach notification laws, PCI standards, and university policies. So in our research group, we've worked on every single one of these except for PCI. So you all are much more expert on PCI, and I won't venture to go there. But on the other issues, we have actually actively worked in this space. So privacy is a real grand challenge. It was identified as such by the Computing Research Association's Information Security Grand Challenges Conference a few years ago. And last year, the National Academy of Engineering put out its Grand Challenges report, and personal privacy and national security was one of their grand challenges. So clearly, threats to privacy are a concern to everyone, whether you're a technologist or not. And we want to try to design privacy into systems and security into systems rather than having it be an afterthought and having to pay the price for that later on. So, this will tell me something about the age of this group with the next thing I'm going to show. How many of you remember this? Yay. So that's great, because when I show this to students now, they look at me with blank faces like they've never seen it, and it tells me something about how long I've been working in this space. So it used to be that on the internet, no one knew you were a dog. But nowadays, not only do they know you're a dog, they know that you are a German Schnauzer mix, German Shepherd Schnauzer mix, that you like to shop for rawhide shoes, that you visited the Lassie website 213 times, that you downloaded that Lassie's, the third Lassie's picture was the hottest, and you downloaded it several times, and they know who you sent it to. So the times, they have changed. And now, of course, we have Facebook, and so dogs are concerned about, like, who's friending them on Facebook as well. So, things are evolving for everyone. So online, how do we assure the public? I mentioned that we've worked a lot on privacy policies. So how many of you have actually read a privacy policy? I would expect this many hands in this kind of a group. How many of you understood those policies? And you all are security professionals. Now imagine, and we are a very, very, very minute percentage of the population. So imagine the average user. So when I've analyzed over 150 privacy policies throughout my career, and this is how I feel when I see them. It says, congratulations, Dave. I don't think I've read a more beautifully evasive and subtly misleading public statement in all my years of government. Okay, so we all know what a privacy policy is. It's basically something that's accessible from your main web page that tells people what your organization's privacy practices are. And the Federal Trade Commission is asked to do this. So I actually went to, I hate to put everybody on the spot, but I actually went to the EDUCAUSE webpage and thought I'd just take a little look at your privacy policy for EDUCAUSE. And it actually looks really good. I didn't run it through any of our tools or anything, but just at a cursory look, it looked fine. But what I did want to talk about is how often should a company or an organization actually look at their privacy policy to see whether or not it needs to be updated? Is it when you make a design to your system? Is it when you install a new, deploy a new feature in your website? Because when that happens, you should probably go back and revisit your privacy policy. And can I tell, as a visitor to your site, when was the last time you updated your site, your policy? So if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of this web page, so it says the effective date is 9/17/04. So that's good from a legal perspective because I know when it was effective, right? But I still don't know when was the last time it was revised. And so here it says the copyright is 1999 to 2010. But it's a copyright for the whole site, not for the privacy policy. And I would imagine that maybe or maybe not, it would be a really good idea to go back and look at your privacy policy to see, because I imagine that over the course of 6 years, things might have changed on the site. So I share this with you because it's something that you might want to go back to your universities to do. And so I'll also share in terms of how do you leverage people, faculty at your department. I think one of the frustrations that some of us as faculty have, speaking completely in confidence, even though I know this is being broadcast, but a lot of times we work in areas and we feel frustrated that we can't help you. And I think a lot of times the perspective is that we're off in our ivory tower. They don't really understand what reality is. And actually, that's not really true. And so I'd like to see us coming more together because you have faculty, or a lot of faculty work in this general area, and you've got expertise nearby. So just a little recommendation for your privacy policies at your university. So given that you have a privacy policy, how do we ensure that that policy complies with law? How can we support different definitions and values pertaining to privacy and legal definitions of privacy? So one of the things that we've done, as I mentioned, we've analyzed over 150 privacy policies, and one of the things that makes it challenging for end users in particular is that we have 57 different keywords that are used in privacy policies. And the challenge is that if you're trying to compare one site to another to decide who you want to whom you want to entrust your information, that the way they use these keywords may differ. And so there's no real standardized vocabulary. So we have a tool that helps analysts to actually analyze privacy policies, and this is actually to help software engineers have a canonical database that they can use to develop software requirements for new systems. We also have developed a privacy taxonomy. By the way, anytime you see a little italicized blue thing under the subject header, that means that there's a publication associated with that slide, and in case you're interested in reading more about it. So we also developed a privacy taxonomy using grounded theory, and we learned that most privacy policies express either protections or vulnerabilities. And the protections generally map to the fair information practices, but the vulnerabilities are things that as software engineers we're really concerned about, because these are kind of the exceptional cases, and when we do requirements engineering, we think of the normative requirements, what we expect to happen in a system. And oftentimes we fail to think about, but what could go wrong? And where are things vulnerable? And so this forces us, if we analyze these vulnerabilities, it forces us to come up with ways that we can thwart these things from happening and ensure that we protect privacy. So how does this taxonomy and what we know about what's expressed in privacy policies relate to what end users think? So are consumers worried about the right things, or what are they worried about? And are companies giving end users the information that they want to know about. So in 2002, we ran a survey. We developed a survey instrument, and we ran a survey, and we had 1,000 internet users participate. And what we learned was that what consumers are most interested in is information transfer, notice and awareness, and information storage. And yet, what privacy policies emphasize is data integrity and security, information collection, and user choice and consent. There's absolutely no overlap between what people care about and what we're telling them and their privacy policies. So obviously there's a misalignment. When we present this information to groups of chief privacy officers and CISOs, we get some really interesting response back, like, ooh, we need to go back and revisit our privacy policies. And so as an academic researcher, it's great when the results of your research are being used by industry and they're actually revising their privacy policies due to what we're able to tell them about what people expect. Getting that knowledge to in academia is a little more difficult, right? And our universities have privacy policies, so I'm really delighted at the opportunity to share this with you now, because industry has had exposure to this. So a lot's happened since we ran that survey in 2002. We now have data breach notification laws. So we ran the survey again last year to see whether privacy values have evolved at all. And so what kinds of things have happened? If you look at this gray line here, corresponds to when we ran our first survey in 2002. And this gray line here, which you can't really see very well, corresponds to when we ran our second survey. These little blue dots correspond to reported data loss events, and the red dots correspond to the introduction of data breach notification laws in different states. And the very first one was, of course, what state? California, right? Always our most progressive state in this regard. So we were interested in seeing, given that all of this is being discussed in the press and, you know, every day in the newspaper you hear about another data breach and another case, we're interested in seeing whether this has changed people's views or beliefs in any way. So we ran the survey again, and what we found is that privacy concerns really remain the same. We doubled the number of respondents this time, and so this time we were able to also do a comparison between U.S. and non-U.S. respondents with statistical significance. So I'll show you that in a second. And this was just appeared in IEEE Security and Privacy in the January-February issue, if you're interested. So I mentioned what's changed. What has changed is the level of concern within those categories. So people are more concerned about disclosures of their purchasing patterns, and they are more concerned about trading and selling of their PII. They have a stronger desire overall to be notified about security safeguards that are being used, but they're less concerned about things that have to do with options of how their information will be used, changes in privacy practices, previously undisclosed changes in the way PII is used. And so if you think about it, how many times do you open up your bank statement or your credit card statement and you have a little privacy policy in there, right? It's like monthly. And when you go to the doctor or the dentist, you get the HIPAA privacy policy. So we've been inundated with things that we don't understand, we don't want to read, the print is tiny. And so it's kind of like we've become desensitized. And so that's not all that surprising. But people are more concerned about websites recording information about where you've previously been on the web. So they're like, yeah, that's my business, you don't need to know that. So that's what's changed. And then we also compared U.S. versus non-U.S. top concerns, and we found that they're generally the same, but the order of the second and third ones have changed. So with that, we also did, given that, we'll set that aside, and we also looked at user perception versus comprehension of privacy policies. I should note, one thing I haven't mentioned is that we work very closely with lawyers, with physicians when we're doing healthcare IT work on electronic health records and personal health records. And we work with faculty who are social scientists to help us with design our survey instruments. And so all of this work is really, really multidisciplinary. And so when I mention that, you know, you should leverage faculty at your universities, the people that you may think, the departments in which you think these people might be, may not be where you think they are. A lot of them are in the law schools. A lot of them are in sociology or communications departments. A lot of them are in the College of Management or the College of Engineering. So cast your net wide when you're looking for them. So Here we go, another funny, you know. Can't tell you what's in our privacy policy. It's private. So we ran an experiment to compare user perception versus comprehension. And we used three healthcare privacy policies from the web, drugstore.com, Health Central, and Novartis. And drugstore had more vulnerabilities expressed in its privacy policies than protections. Health Central was our control. It had an equal number of protections and vulnerabilities. And then Novartis was more protective for consumers. And what we did was that when we showed people these privacy policies, we blanked out the company name. So it was all of them just said Brand X. So what we did was we showed four different representations of privacy policy. So one was the natural language privacy policy, as the ones you see on the web all the time. We also gave another one was a list of goals and privacy vulnerabilities, so from the taxonomy in no particular order. We also gave just the categories of the taxonomy. When you clicked on it, you'd get the actual practices associated with that category. And then finally, we had the natural language policy, and as you hovered your mouse over it, the goal or the vulnerability for each statement would pop up as a little pop-up box. So this is basically what it looked like. This is a natural language. This is, dear friends, first and foremost, Brand X is committed to preserving your privacy. So right off the bat, if you don't read it, you're like warm fuzzies, they're worried about me. Which isn't necessarily true, because you go a little further down and you see, whoa, a little concerning. That's what the goals and the vulnerabilities look like. The categorical list, if you clicked on one of the categories, you'd get the policies that are associated with and any definitions for clarification. And then this is, you know, the pop-up with the goal vulnerability highlights. So we had almost 1,000 participants in this experiment. We used a block design. And in summary, what we found is that users comprehend natural language policies the least, and yet that's the standard. That's what we all use. So simply adding the highlights increased comprehension, and there was a significant increase in comprehension when we showed them the categories. And that makes sense, because people generally do well with abstractions, and so the categories was a bit of an abstraction. But overall, the scores were still alarmingly low, no matter which variant was used. And then in terms of perceptions, people believed that they were more secure sharing PII, their personal PII, with websites that displayed the natural language policies with the highlights. And they also felt that the two natural language variants were better explained. But what we learned was that user comprehension and perception are misaligned. So users feel most protected with the natural language policies, but they comprehend them the worst. So again, this is work that we've presented to CPOs and CISOs, and they're really interested in this because, you know, the good companies want to use this to improve their policies and to help users, right? A malevolent organization might want to use this to their advantage to hide things, and that's when you start getting into the potential bad impacts of your research, that you don't want to encourage that at all. So the takeaway here is to use this to improve our policies and the way we represent them. So I mentioned that we also work in compliance. I'm going to talk a little bit about the legal landscape. So Ernst & Young runs a survey every year of 1,200 organizations with CIOs and CTOs. And compliance with regulation and policy has been the primary driver for information security policy in the past 5 years. And as you know, laws are requiring people to companies and organizations to comply with their policies and with law. And as a software engineer, we really need machine-readable and machine-enforceable policies that we can actually run at runtime so that we can try to prevent privacy breaches from occurring. So the legal problem, this is what typically happens, unfortunately, is that people will specify their system requirements, they design, they get a legal complaint. Whoops, something happened, there was a data breach, what do we do? And then you have to go look at the regulations, didn't realize we weren't following this regulation or adhering to it. And then you have to do redesign and incorporate that, develop new refactor, yada, yada, yada. And so that's what we want to try to avoid. Best practice is to review regulations from the beginning to identify potential software requirements and system requirements, and then specify your systems. And so the RE 2006 corresponds to a paper that we had at the Requirements Engineering Conference in 2006. And at that conference, there were some folks from Cisco who said, you know, we're trying to comply with the Section 508 accessibility regs. We would really love for you to try your approach to see whether you come up with more requirements or find gaps where we're not complying with the law. And so the next paper, the 2008 paper, was the gap analysis that we did with Cisco. And so that paper may be of interest to you as well. And then in terms of HIPAA, which is where I've done most of my work, just in case you're wondering, it's not a female hippopotamus. So what is HIPAA and what makes it so complex? Well, this is a diagram that you intentionally should not be able to see, but it shows the complexity that exists in the HIPAA privacy rule. So these are all of the cross-references that exist within HIPAA to other laws. Okay, that's not even, these are external cross-references. There are a gazillion cross-references to sections within the regulation as well. So we've analyzed each of these 88 external cross-references. We're also doing this for the security rule. Prior research has kind of acknowledged how you might handle internal cross-references, but everyone ignores the external cross-references. It's hard enough to learn or understand one law. Why on earth would you go look at all the laws that are cross-referenced? Well, the challenge is, when you look at papers that are written, they'll say, well, we just assume these cross-references are true. Well, you know what happens when you make that kind of an assumption? You get data breaches, right? And you run into problems where you're not compliant with law. And so that's why we're tackling this. We feel that this is a very important space. So what happens when you examine the cross-references? Well, you might find a conflicting requirements, and here's an example. A HIPAA privacy rule says that that you have to keep PHI for 6 years after the last use. But the Privacy Act says you need to keep for 5 years for the life of the record. So if software engineers focus solely on the privacy rule and don't look at the other regs, you might fail to comply with the HIPAA. So these are the kinds of things that we're looking at in our group. So we're developing some tools to help make sure that our systems are compliant with regs. And so we have a framework where you can develop a production rule model of a regulation, and then you can query it to see whether or not your system is compliant with law. We're developing an adaptability model because one of the challenges is that when new laws come out, they amend existing laws. And as software engineers, we have no clue about the fact that there's a new law. You know, if you're a lawyer, you might be on top of these things, but we don't know which laws might come out in the future. And so this year we had last year we had the ARRA, right, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and the High Tech Act, which amends HIPAA. And so we realized we really need to create an adaptability model that helps software engineers figure out how do I incorporate these new laws and how does it affect the requirements I already have in my systems. We also are developing a traceability model. So as software engineers, we're very concerned about traceability, especially within the field of regulatory compliance. This has been an area that's been researched for many, many years with not too much success, but now we have a real motivation for it. Because if you have a data breach, and you get pulled into a court of law, then if you can show due diligence that you did everything possible and you can trace back from your code to your requirements, to your policies, and to the law, every lawyer we've spoken with says that's enough to get you to kind of let the courts excuse you and not have too much problem, because you just have to show that to the best of, you made reasonable efforts to the best of your ability to satisfy the law. So we're running empirical studies with electronic health records and personal health records, and we have some papers on those, and we're also developing tool support. In addition to this kind of work, we also do some work in investigating data breaches. So we examined the JetBlue data breach a few years ago, as well as a ChoicePoint data breach. And this was really cool because both of these articles served as the inspiration for the covers of IEEE Security and Privacy Twice. So that's not something that you put on your CV, but it's kind of cool. So I'll just make a note, say one thing about the ChoicePoint data breach. And those of you who are, you know, we're in Atlanta right now, and ChoicePoint is in Alpharetta, Georgia. When ChoicePoint had their data breach, there was a landmark Federal Trade Commission landmark fine. So they had to pay $10 million a fine to the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC required them to also set up a $5 million consumer redress fine. When all was said and told and done at the end of it, ChoicePoint had ended up spending nearly $28 million in the FTC fines and the sanctions, as well as in revising and redesigning their business practices and their software systems to comply with those practices. That would drown many a company. It would certainly drown many a university. ChoicePoint survived. Oh, in addition to that, for 20 years, they have an audit, an external audit every 2 years. Okay. So, very expensive, and ChoicePoint eventually got bought out by LexisNexis. Now they are held up as the example, that this is the data broker example of how to best, with the best practices. And so they really, really came out ahead in terms of being a real flagship model in the industry. So how does that relate to us in academia? Well, yesterday in the compliance session, we had some discussion about some individuals said, well, but, you know, loss of reputation doesn't really matter too much. People will still do business with you. So that, you know, it's not really that, it's kind of intangible, it doesn't really matter. Well, let's think about that in terms of how the effect of that on university research. So the High Tech Act requires the Secretary of the Health and Human Services, Department of Health and Human Services, to list breaches of unsecured protected health information of more than 500 individuals on the HHS website. So this is just the main splash on that page. If you scroll down, there are universities that have had these breaches. So what happened? How does that affect us at the university? Well, you've got a lot of researchers at universities. You've got some universities that have medical schools. And so if I'm applying to the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health for a grant, and my university shows up on this list, guess what? I'm competing with other researchers at other universities who haven't had that kind of a data breach. And who are they going to give the grant to? The people who haven't had the data breach. So it's very, it becomes very tangible and very important. And so from our perspective as researchers, we really need you all to help us with this. That's very, very important. It can really, if we have these kinds of data breaches, it can really stifle our ability to do important research in our country. So also consider that we have data mining for anti-terrorism, all these different cases that have happened, and there's public outcry, and people are unhappy, and people are protesting these things. So just a few headlines that are of interest. Here it says that over 40% of federal health insurance contractors and state Medicaid agencies reported experiencing a privacy breach involving personal health information in the past 2 years. Not good. Another one, Blue Cross Blue Shield in California sent letters to physicians in California requesting, with the names of people who had applied for insurance, requesting any information about pre-existing conditions that these people may not have reported. And luckily, the California Medical Association said, no way, this violates patient-physician confidentiality. But, you know, people have a legitimate reason to be concerned about these things. And also, here it says the Department of Health and Human Services has not come up with a way to tie together various initiatives it has ongoing to tackle the thorny privacy and security issues related to exchange of healthcare records electronically. And this is what we don't want to happen, right? Your DNA doesn't match your credit history. So why should we as computer scientists study the law? Well, the cost of noncompliance is really, really expensive, and I won't go through all these. I already mentioned the ChoicePoint case. But you have to be accountable to the law. You have to be able to demonstrate that your policy and system requirements comply with the law. So if you want to see what the state of HIPAA compliance software is, we did a search on HIPAA compliance software on Google, and we got two back-to-back entries. One says, our software fully complies with all current HIPAA regulations. And the very next one says, there is no such thing as HIPAA compliance software. So what are you to do? So a lot of what we do in requirements engineering, which is my area of expertise, really impacts the law. So elicitation is all about where do you find requirements, who do you talk with, who's involved, who are the stakeholders. Everything we do as requirements engineers and analysis is trying to disambiguate and trying to identify conflicts and resolving them early on before you start implementing. And traceability, where we're documenting and tracking requirements. And I always already mentioned why that's important. And also, if you think about what's required for legal compliance, from software engineering, analysis, modeling, and development come to mind. And traditional security activities also, so like policy enforcement and auditing. So if you look at legal text, there are some factors that make it difficult for software engineers to understand them. They're very hierarchical in nature. They are frequently amended. There are a lot of cross-references, which I already mentioned. There are a lot of definitions and acronyms. It's like working with the military, maybe a little better than the military, but not much. And there's a lot of case law and supplemental documents. And then there's a lot of ambiguities in terms of things that are intentional ambiguities and unintentional ambiguities. So I'll give you an example of that in a bit. Software engineers often will rely on a fact or a summary of a law, and then they may be missing a lot of the key things that are actually expressed in the law. So you can't just rely on a fact or a summary sheet. So examples of ambiguity. Intentional ambiguity would be protect against any reasonable anticipated threats or hazards to the security or integrity of such information. So the reason that this is an intentional ambiguity is because a lot of times when lawmakers are writing these regulations, they don't want to pin things down too precisely because they want the courts to decide later, and that's where case law comes from. But then there are also other things that are language ambiguities, like covered entity must promptly document and implement. Well, what does that mean? In software engineering, that's not testable, right? We need to know what does promptly mean. And so there are things that we can do to work with lawmakers to address these issues. So we were presenting our work on our analysis of HIPAA privacy rule to a group of CISOs. And one of the people in the room was Peter Swire, who actually was co-author of the HIPAA privacy rule. And he was sitting next to me, and my PhD student was presenting the work. And Peter just kept going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, I feel so guilty. So why do you feel guilty? He said, because when we were writing this law, we never, ever thought about the fact that you have to write software to comply with it. And we could have written it so differently. And so as a researcher, that's like bingo. That's exactly what we're looking for. We're looking for lawmakers getting the right people in the room to write these laws in such a way that we can actually implement. And it's a very easy thing to do if you get all the stakeholders in the room. So observations thus far lead to technologies for privacy enforcement and privacy auditing. There's a general lack of awareness about regulation and industry. People with the Choice Point case, we became aware that there's a lot of information about us out there that causes new privacy vulnerabilities for individuals. And organizations really need a way to explicitly express their rights and obligations and permissions to ensure that they're actually enforcing their policies the right way. So in terms of getting to the point where we're getting towards regulatory compliance, here's another headline, which says the number of complaints regarding violations of the U.S. Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act continue to increase each year in tandem with an increase in breaches of medical records, according to one security profession. In addition, a growing number of these complaints are going unresolved, so not great. So I mentioned due diligence earlier. So basically this refers to reasonable efforts that you make to satisfy legal requirements and discharge your legal obligations. And we're looking for standard of care where you are showing that you're doing your best to minimize risk, et cetera. So we have developed a methodology for looking at extracting rights and obligations from the law from a software engineering perspective. Remember I mentioned that software engineers will typically just look at the summary or the fact of a law. And so what this approach enables you to do is to actually extract all of the rights that are in the law, which is what the law expresses. And when the right isn't balanced with an obligation, you can skip it. So in terms of looking efficiently through a law to figure out what you really need to worry about, you look for the rights that are balanced with an obligation. So HIPAA has all these rights in it, but there are very few real obligations. Well, not few, but relatively few compared to how many rights there are. And so that looking for that balancing helps software engineers be much more efficient in how you look at these things. So you want to identify constraints, you want to identify ambiguities and resolve them, and you want to make sure that you have traceability. So here's an example of a statement from HIPAA. It says anything that's red is an obligation, anything that's underlined is a constraint, and then we have modal and keywords. And so, again, we're looking for software requirements. And then you'd express this as here we have an obligation followed by two constraints for that particular rule. I'm going through this rather quickly. I don't want to get too much in the technical details here, but just to give you an overview. We've also developed a grammar that helps you develop semantic models so you can query. And we've also shown that you can formalize these statements that you extract from the law. And formalization is important because if you can formalize, it suggests that you can automate eventually. So I mentioned the case study we did in HIPAA with the HIPAA privacy rule. Here's a cutesy little cartoon about the different stakeholders that are involved, but actually it's really complicated because these are all of the stakeholders that are actually mentioned in the HIPAA privacy rule. And what's challenging here is that you can't just do an object-oriented implementation. Like, not everybody inherits everything equally. So it's very challenging. In addition to that, there are a gazillion different priorities and exceptions in the rule, and you have to be able to identify these and prioritize requirements and access control rules accordingly. And so here's just an example of the case study that we did. What kinds of things are in the privacy rule? There's also all kinds of determinations, and these determinations also factor into whether someone is granted access or not to particular information. So I'll just show you an example of some of the legal determinations. So the law says things like who needs the personal health information to comply with its obligations under all these other laws, who is authorized by law to receive reports of child abuse or neglect, so that's a case when you can give information, et cetera. So very challenging if you realize there are a gazillion of these of different kinds. In terms of identifying and resolving ambiguities, here's an example. We have activities that have a subject and action and object. And some transactions have a target, so if you're sending information, for instance. But when the target's missing, you know, okay, there's an ambiguity and it's incomplete and we need to better specify that. And so all the formal models that we've developed help us detect these things automatically. There's also implied rights and obligations, not just the explicit ones. So let's look at the first one. The covered entity requires the individual to request an amendment in writing. So the implied obligation is that the individual must request an amendment in writing. See, it's really quite tedious. So in summary, the work that we've done was the first comprehensive analysis that anyone's done of a regulation to be able to demonstrate that you are accountably compliant with a law. If you don't use a systematic methodology, it really leaves you vulnerable and susceptible to security breaches. And we've also been able to show that you can show due diligence and have a standard of care to help you through these situations as well. So some general recommendations based on the research that I've discussed. You want to make sure that people who design your systems understand laws and policies and that they can ensure that your systems are compliant with law. That means they have to work with lawyers. Lawyers are pretty good to work with on these things. Legalese is ambiguous and difficult to support, so if you use some kind of formalized methods, that can really help you tremendously. And you want to make sure that your analysis leaves you not susceptible to these kinds of breaches. So now I'm going to talk a little bit more, shift gears a bit, and talk a little bit more about what's the impact of faculty research on a university and then how can you leverage that. So the work that we've done in our group in particular, we've brought in $2.6 million from NSF just for the compliance research. And so that's pretty significant. Have I worked with anyone at NC State to help the university with compliance? No. Would I like to? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I suspect you have researchers at your universities that feel the same way. We're addressing a critical shortage of security professionals in the work that we're doing. One really interesting synergy in the work that we're doing is that one of my PhD students was really interested in all these legal issues. And so he's now a third-year JD student, Duke Law student. He's the research editor of the Duke Law Review this year. And so he'll graduate with his JD this year, and he graduates with a PhD next year in computer science. Needless to say, I've got companies clamoring to hire him. And a lot of our students, this is a really important area, and our students are getting all kinds of awards for their work, and that's always very very rewarding for a faculty member. So that's kind of impact on students in the university in terms of budgets kind of things and research. So in addition to that, I'm going to show you a little bit about what I've done on a different scale in terms of government and policy work. I'm just showing you this as one glimpse, but you've got people at your universities who do this too. So I'll note the italicized text here. The faculty lament of all faculty is that a prophet is not recognized in his own land. And so we get asked to go speak everywhere. I advise the government. I advise the Department of Defense. I advise Department of Homeland Security. I advise DARPA. Does my university ever ask me for help? No. Why? Because I'm in my ivory tower, and I have no clue what really real problems that you all are facing are. And so it's really a frustrating thing, and so I'm sharing this with you really just putting it all out on the table, because there are faculty at universities who feel the same way. We work in this. I also work with Intel. I'm on an advisory board at Intel Corporation. So we've got exposure to a lot of things at many different levels, high level to very low level as well. You've got incredible expertise at your university, and so I really encourage you to try to leverage that. So I've worked with an advisory committee at the National Science Foundation, worked with the Computing Research Association. I mentioned DHS. I'm also the co-vice chair of the USACM Public Policy Executive Committee with Ed Felton at Princeton, and then Gene Spafford at Purdue is the chair of that. And so right now what we're looking at is the Cybersecurity Act of 2010 and trying to give feedback to Congress about that before they vote on it. And also we frequently testify before Congress. So on issues that are pertinent from a technical standpoint. So the testimony I did was on the use of Social Security numbers to prevent identity theft and keeping them private. Of course, it was me, the academic who has no, you know, I'm not lobbying, I'm not doing anything, I'm not trying to protect my company, and it was me against all these companies that said, no, there's no other way to uniquely identify someone other than a Social Security number, which we know is not true, and it's just that they don't want to spend the money changing their databases, right? So these are the kinds, just a glimpse at the kinds of things that we're involved in. And then professors have nightmares. So for show and tell, I brought individual credit reports of the entire faculty that I've downloaded from the internet. Like, you know, we just really don't want to see that happen. So how can ISOs leverage faculty? So I've already mentioned you have some real world-class experts at your universities. Look at who at your university serves on high-profile government advisory committees. So I'm just thinking right off the bat, I know people at Cornell, Indiana, Purdue, Berkeley, George Washington University, NC State. I'm missing many. There are many, many people who work on these high-level government advisory committees. There are also people who have security research centers. So at breakfast today, where's the gentleman from UC Davis? We had and your name again was?
Bob.
So Bob and I had a conversation this morning, and he's the example, I think an ideal example of someone who's working closely with two very high-profile security faculty at his university. So he works with Matt Bishop and with Felix Wu, both of whom are luminaries in the security field. And he was mentioning that they run an annual conference every year, and they have a faculty participating in that conference, and it's a regional conference for universities with individuals such as yourself and faculty in security in California. That's a great model of something that you can be doing to engage your faculty and leverage them. I encourage you to collaborate with your faculty. You all have very thorny problems that you're dealing with. We love those. We love it when people come to us with a real problem. Oftentimes, we will do work for free because what we need are real-world examples. And so you bring us a problem, and maybe we have a student or two that we can work on on that, or maybe we set up as a class project and you get some free labor, right, and some really good solutions. And then that turns into a research project, and then it turns into a proposal, and we write a proposal to the National Science Foundation, and it gets funded, and then maybe we can hire one of your people, you know, offset something, or we hire a student to work with you and help you. That's great. That's a perfect model of how things should work in academia. Consider forming an advisory board with your local experts, you know, or having a lunch with them once a semester. You know, I would love it if our IT folks would actually invite me to come chat with them. You might want to hire students as interns. I think many of you might already do that. And I mentioned the running the regional conference. But contrary to popular belief, we don't work in an ivory tower. And the people who work in this particular space in particular are very grounded in real-world problems and can, I think, help you tremendously. Have to mention my collaborators, who work on all our projects. The students in bold red are the ones whose research I've actually talked about today. And I have to acknowledge National Science Foundation and other supporters of our work always when we give talks. And if you want more information, I've got my website in the privacy place, and I'm happy to take any questions.
You mentioned that one key area where the faculty and the information security community have something really in common is the risk that a grant proposal might not get funded.
Yes.
If there have been security breaches or lack of compliance in the institution. In your view, is that currently a theoretical problem, or are you aware of actual cases where otherwise worthy grant proposals were rejected because of security problems?
That's a good question, but this database just went online. So I don't think we've been posted. I don't think there's even been a call since this data went online. So I think we need to give it a year. So for now, it's theoretical. But I will tell you that when we write grant proposals, we now have to explicitly write in the proposal how we're going to protect information that is being collected. And we have to, not only does it require IRB approval, but we have to actually write a whole section on this. And so we need to work with you to figure out how the university is dealing with this. And our grants will not be funded without that in there.
Because it seems to me in many ways the security community could get a lot more attention at top levels if we could point to one of these things. We don't want it local, of course.
Right.
It would really be great to have that exemplar at Stanford to talk about.
Right. And, you know, industry now has choice point to point to, right? 28 million is a lot of money, and people often want to know, well, how much is it going to cost if we do have a problem? And so that's an example of a very expensive problem. We don't, fortunately, we don't have those examples yet in academia, and I hope we never do. But unfortunately, a lot of times it takes something like that to wake up people who are responsible for throwing money our way to be able to address these problems. Okay, well, thank you very much.
A speech by Annie Anton, professor of computer science at North Carolina State University. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.